and gentlemen, boys and girls, Dying Time is here. That's right, it's a Halloween edition of Terror Train on Kill by Kill. It's already going downhill. Hey, greetings and salutations, internets. Your old pal, Patrick Hamilton, coming to you once again from the wilds of Canada somewhere along a rail line. It is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. And so we're going to unpack all the gory details of the 1981 Canucksploitation classic Terror Train in the hopes that a medical school, not graduate, undergraduate? Anyways, if their death, their untimely end, hopefully lets us make a lot of jokes about them. And here, thankfully, to help us in our time of need is the only person that I want to run the rails with. It's the one and only Gina Radcliffe. How are you doing, Gina?
I'm good, Patrick. You know, this movie comes at a perfect time for me because I was just thinking recently that as much as I enjoy the slasher movie genre, what it really lacks is magic tricks.
There are very few Vegas-style showstoppers in modern horror films or in classic 80s slashers.
Yeah, there's a distinct lack of card tricks, of sticking a cigarette through a coin. It's missed so much that there's been a hole somewhere, and this movie, God bless, it fills that space.
It really, really does in a very awkward, stilted and heavily make-upped way. The good news, though, Gina, is that we are not alone as we travel these rails of rampage. The alliteration just flows out from me. It's not like I'm not a professional writer. The good news is that the host of Fun Dip and Cherry Coke is with us today, the one and only Kira Gowan. How are you doing, Kira?
Hello, I'm doing good. Well, I'm very hot, as I think we all are. It's unseasonably warm this time of year, for sure.
We are sweating buckets. It's summer part three here in Southern California.
Yes, the real horror here is climate change.
That is true.
And so if you feel the sweat coming through the podcast, know that we're suffering for our art and for you. So as is tradition here on the Kill by Kill podcast, we always like to ask our guests where the first time they came in contact with the movie is. And so, Kira, where did you come across Terror Train for the first time?
When you suggested that we do it for this podcast, I had never heard of it, although I'm familiar with Jamie Lee Curtis, I guess is probably the only actor in here that I recognized. But yeah, this podcast was the first time I've ever seen it. One thing about me is it's kind of embarrassing. I host a podcast about movies, but I haven't really seen that many. So almost anything you suggested would have been new to me.
Yeah, that's really okay. No one's asking you to be an expert here.
That's true. And the point of my podcast is to fill in the gaps. So,
Terror Train was one of Jamie Lee's string of films that she did after the success of Halloween. Her and her management team sought out deals where she could be the star in various vehicles. First came Prom Night, and Terror Train followed soon after. This was also filmed in Canada. It is also filled with disco.
It is also filled with padded out scenes, such as in Prom Night, it was a extended disco dancing sequence. In Terror Train, it's we're gonna keep mentioning a magic show. There's a lot of magic tricks in this, in as part of a not terribly convincing red herring, but there's a lot of magic, a lot of sleight of hand. And after a while, I too was like, tended to react to it like one of the characters in the movie, just a look of scorn.
Yeah, yeah.
Not only do we get to see lots of magic, we get to see someone fail at heckling magic. Which, I mean, at one point, you don't know who to hate more. And then you're supposed to root for the magician in a situation. And I'm like, this is a bridge too far.
if it's him or the teens, like, I was kind of on his side for most of it. The teens were super drunk and obnoxious the whole time.
I feel like, are we kind of building up to a sort of, like, spoiler or stunt casting as to who the magician is?
I mean, I wasn't going to say it because it was, like, so spectacular, like, when it shows up in the credits.
It's bizarre. Patrick, could I spoil it for the listener?
Oh, please.
It's David Copperfield. It's David Copperfield. Which is just like, he's not playing himself. I mean, although of course he is, but I am pretty.
He's not playing himself either.
I am pretty sure this is.
Yeah, he's just David Copperfield as the magician.
Yeah, I think that's literally how he's credited, is the magician. And the movie sort of sets him up as a potential love interest for Jamie Lee Curtis's character. And they have a staggering lack of chemistry. It's like there's not enough spark between the two of them to light a can of Sterno. It's just like watching somebody make conversation with their cousin at a family reunion. There's just nothing there, not a thing. And I am pretty sure this is his only acting role. I could be wrong. I may need to go to the Wikipedias for that. But go ahead, Patrick, and continue setting up the plot for this.
Yeah, as you said, there's not a lot of chemistry here, but the movie wants to tell us that romance is in the air. And then these two manage to put a large fan nearby so that it clears all the romance out of the way. We're just left with them awkwardly flirting with one another. But before all of that happens, before we actually board said terror train, we have our setup. The thing that the rest of the movie depends upon to give it fuel. Yeah. This is the inciting incident, and it happens like most of these movies do, with Jamie Lee Curtis and her required by law two girlfriends flanking her as they talk, and we don't get to hear what they're saying at a frat mixer, I suppose.
A New Year's Eve bonfire. Which, yeah. I think is a strong way to start a movie. Any movie that starts with a bonfire, I'm pretty much there for it. Usually it's like a campfire, but I'm there.
Well, this is a campfire on steroids. I mean, as far as bonfires go, this is pretty bitchin'.
Yeah, that's true.
I personally felt like, as in terms of a frat party, though, it didn't exactly light my knickers on fire. As far as traditions, lighting a banner on fire is not what I would call a showstopper.
Well, they're medical students, so maybe they're a little more serious-minded. I'm going to come back to the medical student thing in a minute with the prank gone wrong, which is, of course, the favorite of slasher movie tropes. You know, I think pretty much, I would say, 75% of slasher movies start off with a prank gone wrong.
Well, one thing that kind of leads to them not being that serious is the hats that they make the virgins wear. those weird, God, I don't even know.
Yeah, they are very, it seems like something out of Mad Magazine. It doesn't really seem like reality. Yeah. It seems like what somebody was told they do in college,
right,
as opposed to a real thing.
Right.
Yeah, that's definitely true. That's something, you know, oh, this is all crazy stuff that kids do in college, like planting a dead body in someone's bed.
So the girls are on one side, giving googly eyes to the guys on the other. Amongst the guys is a fellow who never speaks aloud, and we are told that his name is Kenny. Kenny looks like a cartoon bird who is wrapped up hastily in a flesh suit. And he's apparently going to be honey-trapped by Alana, who is Jamie Lee Curtis's character. By that, he's going to be led into something. What he's being told is Jamie Lee Curtis is a sure thing, and you're gonna go up to this hastily decorated bedroom surrounded by construction lights. nothing says romance quite like move over to the right because the left lane is closed for repairs.
And when I was watching this, my audio was kind of weird. So all I could hear, I couldn't hear any of the dialogue. All I could hear were the sound effects, and those lights made the loudest clicking noise. So if you ever want to watch it in like a very weird way, just like break your cable to your speakers a little bit. It was very surreal.
So Jamie Lee Curtis goes up ahead of him, hides behind a massive bedpost, and then lulls him forward. Force, I wouldn't say forces, but cajoles him into taking off his clothes and getting into bed.
He doesn't take that much.
Yeah, and he and he's, can I say that he is wearing some disturbingly skimpy panties in this scene. They are very, for someone who is, you know, supposed to be very shy and nerdy, he's got some teeny tiny undies on.
And I was very jealous of his thighs. I'm just gonna put it out there. They were thin and long, and I was like, oh man.
Yeah, his legs go all the way up to whatever the hell's on top of them. Not to body shape him, but he was hired for a body type. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. We'll get to that more later. Unfortunately. So she cajoles him into bed, asks him, kiss me, Kenny, kiss me. He leans down to do so. Now, what we don't know, what we obviously know and Kenny doesn't, is that there seems to be a prop person in bed, a mannequin. Oh, no, no, no. It turns out to be a dissected corpse whose arms immediately fall off. And then Kenny,
oh my God, this meltdown. It's a little over the top. It's like Douglas Sirk esque spinning in circles while screaming freak out, and I love it. He gets himself just tangled up in those filmy curtains, and it's just, and I really want to know. I read an interview with the actor who played Kenny, and he very much thought he was making something artistic here, and like, especially when you read about, I should post it on our Facebook page, because when he goes into all this work he did in developing this character, and you know how he thought, why he should react a certain way that he did. So I think this is all his idea. This wailing and whirling around like Stevie Nicks, and then they slow it down so it sounds all the more, you know, bizarre and haunting. And I love it so much that I was delighted that they did it twice in this movie.
I mean, he has a distinct reaction. He just spins and spins and spins in gauze. And I'm sure a young Michael Bay watched this and just immediately became erect and said, if they just gave him two guns, this would be perfect. It is just a whirling dervish. And then everyone else is kind of laughing, but Jamie Lee Curtis is kind of like, oh, this didn't go how I expected.
Which,
but
like,
guys...
Yeah.
What the fuck did she expect?
On the other hand, though, he is a medical student. So one would wonder why he's... I mean, I understand being surprised and perhaps angry that a dead body has been planted. But he's just acting like this is nothing he's ever seen before, and just aghast. And he just... His psyche immediately just snaps like a twig at the sight of this dead body in front of him. It's like, you... seen one of these before, have you not? They're supposed to be in there with,
I mean, theoretically he's a freshman.
Well, maybe, okay,
so
fair enough, but then clearly he's not cut out for medical school.
His psyche is on a slippery slope. He is practically insane before he enters this, and then goes beyond insane into some other sort of dimension of crazy.
Yeah, it's there's right. No, I mean, I feel like that's almost the high point of the movie, and it takes a long time to get back up there.
That is the minor pacing problem that this film has, is that it after this, let's call it a sex prankageddon, it happens that after that there's a large lull as we now actually meet each of these individuals who participated in the prank itself.
I mean, let's face it, the only characters that really matter are Alana, who is the final girl, and Doc, who is the real fucking asshole of the story. There's always one, and oh boy, is he a real fucking asshole. And it takes way too long for his character to be killed off. Now it's a satisfying death. Don't get me wrong. Albeit largely off screen, but this character is just like, wow. just he's just scowling and awful, and in a way that doesn't. I mean, now granted, as is the point of the podcast, they don't really spend a whole lot of time developing these characters, so it's the audience doesn't get to find out why anybody would want to be friends or spend more than a minute in this guy's presence, and why he has a girlfriend and why he has friends at all. But I mean, other than that, I mean, there's really the other characters aren't really around long enough to make any sort of real impression.
Everyone's very quickly isolated.
Well, Mo is
Well, yeah, Mitchie is Doc's girlfriend, sort of, and Mo is Alana's boyfriend, but who goes along pretty much with everything Doc tells him to do.
Yeah, we're gonna get to a sequence that was when I all of a sudden woke up. Like I was like, okay. And then those Doc and Mo have a conversation where something is said, and I was like, oh, what? Well, now I'm interested in this movie. Okay, that's a teaser. But just so that everyone knows who may not be familiar with Terror Train, Doc is played by an actor and director named Hart Bochner. This is basically a movie-long audition for what would become his most famous role in Die Hard. He's the yuppie asshole Ellis in that movie. And this is basically Ellis in medical school before he flunked out and decided to take up finance with Nakatomi.
Yeah, that's true. That is his other big role, isn't it?
This and, you know, eventually directing PCU. That is Hart Bochner's milieu.
I've never seen either of those movies.
You could skip PCU. You probably should watch Die Hard at some point.
I should watch Die Hard. I know.
So from this original sex prank again, we then cue the Lifetime original movie text of 3 years later.
3 years later.
And we now see a bus full of ex-graduating college students, but also there's some undergrad. This is a whole big frat party, just like we saw at the beginning, only now it's 3 years later.
I was also confused because they're talking about that it's a New Year's party, which is not the same time as graduation time. So the timing of it was very confusing to me.
Yeah, maybe Canadian medical students graduate a different way.
Blame it on Canada. But
yes, cool. Why not? That works. Listen, the movie doesn't feel important to tell me. Why should I wonder out loud about it?
That is true.
And so we now get a quick body count started, of course, with Jamie Lee Curtis. She starts off in braless in a pirate shirt. So the movie's got that going for it. Then we got Ed, who's a one-liner machine, and by that I mean he's kind of the class clown, but on cocaine.
Yeah, he sucks.
He really, really does. With Alana's BFF and roomie, Mitchie, I thought she was playing a sort of a monk, but it turns out she's playing a witch, and they should really have thought about maybe making that mask a different color, because I couldn't tell the fucking difference.
Did not know what her costume was at all.
No. It's slinky and it's black, and that's about as much thought as they put into it. Then we have Jackson, and he's a guy with, he has hair, and he's wearing a Slithus costume.
Patrick just said he's the black guy.
He's the black guy. That's all the characterization he's given. It's not that he shouldn't have been cast, and it's not that he's not worthy of more. They just don't give him a damn fucking thing to do.
He is miraculously not the first character killed, as is usually tragically the fate of characters of color in slasher movies. But he's near the first, but not the first.
He's first.
And there's
adjacent.
Nothing really dislikable about him. Like he's fairly likable.
He's just a goof, a college goof, in a pretty bitchin' elaborate Halloween costume.
Yeah,
for sure.
But it's not Halloween; it's New Year's.
Well, if you had a costume like that, I mean, you'd recycle it for several events. Come on, that had to cost some cash.
And is it New Year's? Like the timing, I was getting hung up on it. I think it was New Year's, but the costumes don't make sense in that case. Like,
I think it was just some sort of masquerade party. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I took it as, that it was a masquerade ball sort of situation, just on a
on a train.
I do not know where I got New Year's from.
Because it's 3 years after the initial incident, okay. which was on New
which
Year's.
Was. That makes so sense. In, That's probably yeah. what it was.
Listen, I think your math okay. lines up. Don't doubt yourself.
Okay.
And then we, of course, the aforementioned David Copperfield, who's the magician.
The magician.
Although the majority of the time he's playing the angry magician, and he is not ready for prime time
here. The scowling magician.
He's just angry about the gig. He's angry about the place. He's angry. Although he's got a lot of production value. There's lights and music fucking going on in that train car. That's a lot of production yeah. value for an inside a train car magic show.
My note about him was that he looks looks like an evil Topher Grace. So that was kind of
I can see it. My note. I think that most of his direction for the character in the script was stares intently, because that's what he does. He stares yeah. a lot, very very intensely.
There's if that lot. Was asked of him, he delivered.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. He definitely fulfilled his role in that regard.
We have Alana's aforementioned boyfriend Mo, and he pretty much looks like a wax dummy of a young William Shatner that's been left out in the hot sun too long. He's one of those things where he has very thin lips, like George W. Bush. And when he smiles, the lips disappear, and it's just very untrustworthy.
He also has the strongest Canadian accent.
Oh, he's sorry. Yeah, he's sorry about that accent.
He definitely says sorry.
A lot. Alana, I'm sorry. Don't be upset. I'm so sorry.
He has a lot to be sorry about, though. So,
oh my God, does he ever? And then, really, along the offshoots here, we have Oscar winner Ben fucking Johnson from The Last Picture Show. He's playing Karn, the concerned conductor.
He's the heroic train conductor, as it turns out.
Absolutely. He's the kind of guy who just wishes you would put a damn radio on this train. Meanwhile, is Karn doing it with that secretary?
The one in the wheelchair?
Yeah.
No, I think they're just sort of, you know, had that coworker flirting thing going on.
I don't dance with a lot of my coworkers that aren't my wife.
He seems so avuncular to me.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a guy who wants to sit around, have endless conversations about the future of railway travel. There's nothing. I think he's a good guy.
Oh my God! You know, for a slasher movie, this film features a lot of debates about the future of Winnebagos versus trains. It feels like it takes up half the movie.
It was so pointless and not interesting.
It never becomes interesting, and yet the film is like, let's have another conversation about it. We need to pad this out to 88 minutes. Also on the periphery, you have Pet, who's played by Connexploitation all-star Joy Bushell. She went on to be in movies like Quest for Fire and Humongous and The Lady Who Lounges Around Jeff Goldblum's Apartment in nothing but a jean jacket and panties in The Fly. She's in a lot of Canadian stuff. And she's usually not dressed in much.
Is she the one?
Was she the one whose costume was a pair of pants?
Yeah, with like a
pair
hand.
Of pants with a yeah, hand coming out of it.
That's yeah. another one. I was like, huh? What is this costume supposed to be?
Yeah, I don't know what she's masquerading as necessarily. That's not a masquerade so much as just a. Is that supposed to represent a barrel, or is that meant to evoke that there really is a man inside her pants?
Oh boy, trying to get out?
Well, there's a man in all of our pants trying to get out. That's half the fucking problem.
Yeah.
This movie gets it right away. It gives you one of its most annoying characters and instantly sets him up as terrible. You don't want to see him after he opens his mouth the first time, and certainly not after he begins to do a terrible roast level stand-up routine before they even board the fucking train. But hey, you know what? You don't have to worry about Ed too long, because he gets a sword right through the fucking gut from the word go.
Yeah, before the train even leaves the station, and absolutely no one notices.
Everyone is thrilled.
And this is one of two times in which someone is murdered right in front of like a dozen people. And yeah. You know, and certainly in the second one, the second murder, it's, oh, well, I did something and you didn't notice I was there. It's like, no, someone's going to notice that you're there. You know? I mean,
yeah.
But I love that poor Ed just collapses onto the tracks and then the train slowly rolls over his head.
So he rolls over his body. I mean, that's satisfying, actually.
Although, if I'm not mistaken, his prop blow-up doll does make it onto the train.
True. Well, she's important. She will go on to be vastly important to the plot of this movie, which is strange to say, but true. RIPD, Ed, I'm glad you're gone. And I like that his safari helmet is crushed before the rest of his body is. That's filmmaking. This movie was made by Roger Spottiswood. This was his first movie, although he'd been an editor for a long time before this. And now this basically sets up one element that will be true for the rest of the movie, and that is the killer then dons the costume of the person that he's just murdered. So we actually have a real mystery-ish in this slasher mystery.
Oh, that's so generous.
And it allows a lot of the oh, it's you trope.
Unlike Happy Birthday to Me, where people just say it to a figure off camera and we just see their shoes. Like, this posits a world in which someone could be recognizable to other people, and you would assume that, hey, you're that person who I saw with that mask on. And as long as they don't say anything out loud, they can kind of get away with it.
Or if no one notices that your height has changed, or that you've lost or gained 30 pounds in the space of an hour, or
that you're not black anymore.
Or you know, you had breasts at one point, now you don't anymore. And I mean, the person who it is fairly slight, but which would make possibly disguising himself as a female more plausible, but not probably a 6 foot tall man.
It's right. A little inconsistent, but at least it's a concept I can get behind, even if it's not entirely successful all the time. At least they're going for something. The killer dons Ed's costume and almost lures Mitchie into to her doom, like almost right away. But then he very quickly sets his sight on Jackson, the guy in the Slithus lizard costume. They then go off into a bathroom, and Jackson gets his head pulverized into a mirror almost immediately. I don't know that the killer, I guess psycho strength is what's happening here, because Jackson has about 75 pounds on our killer. Typically.
Yeah, he's definitely as weaker as strong as the movie requires him to be.
At some times it's hard for him to hold onto the wrists of a rather frail woman. Other times he's strong enough to ram what looks like a NFL linebacker into a mirror. Granted, Jackson is drunk, but I don't think he's that drunk. Anyways, blood's everywhere, and I don't think his throat actually gets cut. I think there's just glass on top of his throat. I can't tell.
Yeah, I think getting your head smashed into a mirror probably would do the trick.
That's all it would take for me, frankly. I'm that fragile. I hate to admit it, but it's true. But what we learn throughout this is that Alana does not like Doc. The sex prankageddon that happened really, you know, created a divide in their relationship. But Mo and Doc have a very, what would you call their relationship? Doomed? Psychologically fraught? Possibly romantic?
Yeah, wasn't there a point when one of them said, like, you know, I'm here for you if you need anything or whatever, and the other one was like, yeah, whatever, and the other guy was like, no, I really mean it.
Yes. That's when I perked up.
It was like very intense.
That's when I was like, this movie got really fucking interesting to me.
There is an interesting, almost like a Doc has a psychological hold on Mo, and I don't know that it's poor script writing and they just didn't develop this, Mo meekly goes along with a lot of stuff that Doc tries to get him. And I mean, these aren't kids. These are people in their early to mid 20s. And you, I know our girlfriends are right on this train, but let's go pick up these other girls and take them to our cabin. Hey, what they won't know, what they don't know won't hurt them. Oh, okay, Doc, whatever you say.
Yeah, it's super odd, but they have such a hold on one another. I guess Doc uses Mo because Mo has money, or comes from money at the very least. And Mo doesn't have much of a personality, and so he leans on Doc, I guess.
Doc is like the taller, handsome one, so like, why wouldn't you just try to be just like
him? Yeah, but he's horrible.
True.
His sole redeeming quality is that he's vaguely handsome.
Yeah. Yeah, that's enough.
I mean, I suppose
that gets people a long way.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose certainly in a movie, yeah, that does take you pretty far. But I mean, just talk about a completely irredeemable character in every possible way.
Oh yeah.
I'm right there with you. There's not much to say about him that's super awesome. And I don't know that I feel all that great about Mo. I mean, to be honest with you, I think they'd be better off with one another because they'd remove each other from the rest of humanity. Because when Mo is trying to get back in Alana's good graces, he always asks her questions. And as she starts to answer, he talks over her. It's like we're on the Mansplanation Express. He's terrible. Yeah. I don't like him. I don't like Doc. This frat is full of fucking assholes.
As is par for the course, let's just face it.
Yes, very true. So it's a total reality. In between all of this, we get a lot of backstory on Karn about how he wants to get out of the train game. And also, thinks that people are dummies for not selling Winnebagos. And a lot of disco magic. Just tons of disco magic.
And magic tricks.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the magic tricks. I really liked them. They were really fun. The cigarette going through the quarter.
I mean, usually you only see that up close when your cousin who's in fifth grade shows it to you. But here you have David fucking Copperfield doing that basic magic trick. And
this movie had that going for
it. It's fun adjacent at the very least.
Okay, fair enough.
In the middle of that magic scene when he's on stage, there's a very tight shot of one girl in the audience who has the largest amount of hair I've ever seen on one head. But you combine that with the hipster glasses that she's wearing, and basically she is what Paul Thomas Anderson has been masturbating to since he was 12.
How did I miss her? That sounds amazing.
I wish I had the ability to screen cap as much as I used to. I will try to get a shot off the television to show people because it is magnificent. Like, this is the best background player in any movie that we've covered so far. That's really saying something.
Even better than the lady with the eye patch in Jason Takes Manhattan.
Oh, well, she's great, though. I want to know her backstory. I don't need to know this girl's backstory. So maybe eye patch lady has it going on. You're right. But you're right again, Gina.
What can I say?
As always.
As always.
Yeah. As always.
As always.
So, yeah, after Jackson gets killed, Karn discovers the body. Then when he goes to alert other people and bring them to it, someone has cleaned up the crime scene.
Is the killer kind of messing with Karn? And if so, why?
I don't know if they mean to mess with Karn, or he just always meant to clean up the crime scene. That person just hadn't gotten to it yet. And the timing worked out for them. But there was a lot of blood in that bathroom to clean up. And they only find one towel that is splashed slightly with stage blood. So,
this character definitely has a little bit of the ability to bend time and space. And be in more than one place and at one time. And I'm also greatly, greatly impressed by his ability to change out of various outfits and put on makeup and remove makeup and apply nail polish and remove that nail polish over and over and over again.
Not to give anything away, but we have ourselves another little Mrs. Doubtfire situation going on.
I think the makeup is explainable because he was always wearing a mask.
True.
So that is probably explainable. But the nail polish thing, that's a good call on that. I didn't really think about that, but you're totally right.
Yeah, very true. So along this line, there's also a band on one of the train cars. They don't play a good song the entire time.
I need to submit them to Beyond Yacht Rock.
They just want your funky love, Gina. That's all they want. I had to turn on the closed captions to make sure that I got all of the great lyrics of that song. And I did not find any beyond I Just Want Your Funky Love.
And the band didn't even register for me until the scene where they have to break the train and everything just goes flying. And then I was like, oh, there's a band this whole time.
That drummer is pretty good at holding on to his drum kit while the train breaks.
Yeah. Though. Yeah.
As far as Star Trek body acting to what is not really happening, that drummer is one of the better.
There were actually a couple scenes of actors moving in strange ways on sets that probably were not moving. There was one between Alana and the conductor that they were both kind of like rocking back and forth in sync, and it was kind of funny if you didn't know they were on a train.
It should be noted that Jamie Lee Curtis's character is apparently addicted to peanuts. She spends a lot of the time in the movie eating peanuts or trying to get more peanuts. It's a very odd affectation, but one I found delightful. Oh yeah, we get a fun racist diatribe in the middle of the movie. That was a hoot and a holler. One of the beanie virgins from earlier on later plays a more prominent role here, dressed as an Uncle Sam who goes off on a anti-Middle East thing that does not cut away, and you just hear racist joke after racist joke, and I was not pleased by that. That bit did not age well.
No, and you could tell that he just thought he was doing his practice for open mic night.
Oh, that open mic should be closed permanently.
Yeah. But he was one of the virgins from the 3 years ago because he was wearing that dumb hat. But he's since had sex because he's not wearing the hat anymore. And I interpreted it as him having sex. It gave him the confidence to become an asshole just like everybody else.
That would do it. That would certainly do it.
That's... Yeah,
it unlocked his potential, and thank God the cameras were there to capture.
What a relief.
Now, Karn also serves a different purpose, and that is to constantly update us as to the plot machinations of what's happening. He's the person who says aloud the stuff that the filmmakers want to make sure the audience knows, like, oh my God, he could be changing costumes. We wouldn't know what he looks like. So thanks for that.
It's like, in case you're not paying attention, which no, not really.
Yeah. What if he switched costumes? What if you were the center of his fury? What if your past is coming back to haunt you? He says it all.
It's also, I think, a little irresponsible of him to not let everybody know as soon as he realizes there's a killer on board, because he tries to cover it up and like keep everybody calm for probably a little bit too long, in my opinion.
Yeah, we got a mayor from Jaws situation happening here.
Yeah, and where the hell is this train going? Because the way they are treating it, it's like out in like the Yukon or something where there's just no stations they could possibly stop at between where they left and where they're going. I mean, this is just like is this supposed to be like an overnight train ride, or it's a couple hours? Because this is there's no possible way they could stop the train anywhere.
I assume that this is kind of some sort of show route that they take it on. I'm reminded of in Wisconsin, when we go back for Christmas, they'll do the sort of Christmas train where it takes you from the center of town out to one remote part where they have a Christmas village
where Santa is, and those are the only two places that train goes. So its only purpose is basically to transport people from the center of Madison out to this shanty town where they put up a quote unquote Santa, if you believe that, and then head on back. I assume it's that sort of thing where it's this train is hired out for parties or train demonstrations.
And I was just sort of imagining sort of a like a Snowpiercer situation where it just like can't stop because it's too cold.
That is also possible.
So
at one point when knows? Everyone is told, when everyone gets off and they start doing a head count and they're all like, we're not getting back on the train with a killer, which is a reasonable concern. Yeah. Karn says, there's nowhere to go. You can't walk down from here. You'd freeze to death. And a lot of people are like, I don't know. I'm wearing tights. I think I could make it.
Tights are warm. Get those fleece lined ones.
If I were wearing tights right now, I'd slide right out of them. I'm sweating buckets.
Ugh. Yeah. Yeah.
If anyone was wondering if Jamie Lee Curtis learned how to disco dance better in between prom night and here, the answer is a firm no.
No. No.
No. She's still bad at it. The choreographers, if there was one on here, did not help her any more than the prom night choreographers. It's it's a kind of a sad white man's overbite situation yet again. She has many skills, but that is not among them.
Bad dancing is very relatable to me, so it didn't even register.
So Karn believes that the killer is now wearing Jackson's Slithus lizard costume, but Mitchie doesn't know that. And later on, after watching a semi-competent magic demonstration by David Copperfield, who's wearing so much makeup. It's in, he is wearing makeup for people in a different train car.
Yeah.
That's how much he has on.
His face looks like it's made of suede.
I wrote down that he basically comes off like an over-intense Robbie Benson.
Yeah, he's very intense, and as I mentioned before, like the movie flirts with that, you know, this is going to be some sort of romantic interest for Jamie Lee Curtis, and most of it just involves them staring at each other, and it's a little disconcerting at times.
I mean, she has more chemistry with Karn than she does David
Copperfield. She really does. It's a little fatherly, but you know, definitely they have more of a rapport with each other. They speak, which is more than she can accomplish with David Copperfield. But
yes.
I don't know if he, you know, this was supposed to be stunt casting with making him this character, but they try a lot of different things with him that just do not work. Like, initially, they try for a love interest, and then, for whatever reason, about halfway through the movie, Jamie Lee Curtis decides, oh, it must be him. He must be the killer. Why? Well, we don't know. It must be him. Why wouldn't it be him?
She carries on a yearbook investigation, in which we discover that Kenny, the kid involved in the sex prankageddon, was into magic, and therefore it must be the magician. Now, if you saw Kenny, the actor who played Kenny, and David Copperfield next to one another, this would be impossible. You would not confuse these two. There's no amount of plastic surgery one could get inside of the insane asylum that we are told he has been booked into that could make Kenny into David Copperfield. But that's what the movie tries to tell yeah. us.
And only 3 years has passed, though.
So. Yeah, I did not buy that for a hot second.
I mean, it's also one of those things where it's like, oh, he was in a magic. No one booked the magician onto the train is the other clue that we're given. That just the magician just showed up. And there's a lot of lighting and sound stuff that goes into David Copperfield's show for him to just randomly show up on this fucking train. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but none of the movie makes a whole lot of sense. That's okay.
Somebody had to book him. He showed up and was complaining about this gig he had to do on a train. So somebody had to book him.
Yeah.
I mean, he makes a lady disappear in a very small space. So I'll give him this.
he puts on a decent train magic show. Anyways, Mitchie sees that Doc is trying to make time with Jackson's girlfriend and Pat, and so she...
What was her costume?
Mitchie's or Jackson's girlfriend?
Was she like an ice princess?
A Cleopatra,
I was going to say, I thought she was like a harem, okay. Or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's some mixed messages in terms of what exactly
what she's got going
what
on.
Historical reference is being made there, but it's like a genie, a Cleopatra, one of those.
We did not.
Okay, as long as it wasn't something that was like super clear that I just didn't get.
It's a sexy Cleopatra.
What we didn't mention okay. is that this character is played by Prince Protege Vanity.
Gina, you just blew my mind. Are you serious?
I am.
I did not find that in my research. That is so... This is the best role she ever played. This is the best she ever acted.
Oh, no.
Her costume... No, wait a second. I'm looking at her costume right now. There's shells on it. She's supposed to be a mermaid. That, okay. Oh my god, that really did not register the two other times I watched shiny. This movie in preparation for this podcast. So there you go. We can't tell what costumes are because they're exceedingly vague. Anyways, Mitchie decides, well, if you're going to get down with Vanity, I'm going to grab Jackson and I'm going to totally do him in an upper berth. And
with the lizard costume on, apparently.
Ugh! Oh my god.
I'm just not into having sex with somebody in a costume with a mask on. That doesn't seem like a good time.
A rubber costume at that.
Yeah, I think the mask is the least of your worries when the costume is made of rubber. Like, ugh! Like, she does ask him to take the glove off at one point, but that's. That's it. Still got the rest of it on.
Well, she asked him to take the glove off. He does. And the hand is particularly inanimate. It also appears to be the high melanin count of an African-American gentleman. But it also turns out to be a severed hand. And
she says one of my favorite lines in the movie in that scene. She says, "Cold hands, warm heart." She's like, no!
That's a lot of wishful thinking going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Once she discovers that is a severed hand, she begins to scream her head off. But luckily for the killer, the train knows when someone is screaming because it always has a train whistle go off at the moment someone screams their head off. It's like it's timed or something. Or someone hits a button.
Or just convenient cutting.
Yeah. That's when we get that really awkward seduction maneuver by David Copperfield on Jamie Lee Curtis that also involves peanuts. It's
he knows what a woman likes. She likes peanuts.
The way to a woman's heart is a salty snack. Especially if you...
That's very true.
There's plates of it everywhere, but she still wants it out of a vending machine. It's very... I don't get it at all. Oh, boy. Mitchie's throat is slashed. Karn discovers the body, and then he again takes off, tries to cover it up, and then goes off somewhere else to do something. But he ends up dragging Alana, Jamie Lee Curtis's character, back to, I don't know, she doesn't believe Mitchie could possibly be dead.
He has a shoe. He says, "Whose shoe is this?"
Yeah, right? And then she says, "That's Mitchie's shoe."
She's like, "It's Mitchie's.
Where is Mitchie?" And then she goes crazy in the birthing section, just ripping open curtains, trying to find it. And our killer has not been able to move Mitchie's body, and her throat has been slashed. And so, yeah, that's when we get our first of what is Gina Radcliffe's favorite thing, Jamie Lee Curtis screaming.
It's a very good favorite thing.
She hates it.
Yeah, it's...
Oh, I love it. She collapses on the ground, and she's so great.
She's a little less shrill in this than she was in prom night. I will give her that.
And we also that's not the only character that has a really shill scream, though. We learn a little bit later on that Doc has one of the craziest screams outside of Reggie the Reckless I've ever heard in a film. It's really high pitched and it's super, super crazy.
Yeah, but it's so nice to hear because he has it coming so bad.
Mm-hmm. Doc also manages to discover Mitchie's body. That's when we hear his crazy ass scream. And he tries to stop the train, but when he hits the brake, nothing happens. And so that means Karin has to go figure out what the hell happened. It turns out that the conductor and the guy who shovels coal, who is really into some sort of crazy dream where the future is train driven. I don't know if he read, not The Fountainhead. What's the one where everyone in the future is traveling?
Atlas Shrugged.
He's got some sort of Atlas Shrugged thing happening.
Yeah, it might be the only slasher movie that has a John Galt like character in it.
He's so bent on individualism that he believes that train travel is the future. It's the dumbest fucking idea in the world.
He's just got to invent a special kind of metal, and then you never know.
Yeah, sure, why not? Listen, I'm not gonna say it's impossible. I'm just gonna say it's very fucking unlikely.
I'm gonna say that Atlas Shrugged is impossible. I'll go that far.
So Karin finds a bloody conductor hat, and then the crew clears the train. They manage to slow it down in the middle of an overpass, and now we're gonna do the responsible fucking thing, and that is get a head count and figure out how many people in this party are dead.
Wait, did we skip over? Did we mention Mo yet?
I think Mo might still be with us.
No, Mo's death does portend this. That's okay. When that. My apologies. That's when Doc's scream really comes into play. During the magic show, at some point, there seems to be one stab wound on his neck, and then it turns out he's slashed in a couple different places. But all this happened in the middle of the magic show, and I am still unsure as to when it happened.
Yeah, the killer tries to explain it, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense because it also depends on how much the audience would buy that the people watching the magic show are so enraptured with what's happening on stage that they would fail to notice in a very small room. I mean, I've not been on a huge like cross country or cross states train, but I mean, those are pretty tiny little spaces, and I'm not sure, you know, short of sawing someone in half, how distracted I would be by a magic show that I would not see someone come out into the audience and murder someone next to me.
And the fact that Mo doesn't say anything.
Didn't David Copperfield, like, disappear himself into the audience? Was that when he did that? When, do you remember? Oh, boy.
There is a set. Yeah.
He disappeared himself and then popped up in the back of the audience.
Yes. There's a sequence where he sits himself in a chair and has Vanity put a cloak over his head. She counts to seven or something and pulls the sheet off and he has disappeared. The camera reverses and he's in the middle of the fucking audience. And everyone's like, what?
So something like that.
Yeah, but still, I mean, if someone is being murdered right next to you, you're going to notice that.
I would think, but these people are assholes.
The world's most preeminent magician. So, like, he's very distracting.
He is. Well, he's figured out, like Jason knows everyone's, sex sitch, David Copperfield knows what you want deep down. Most people want a magic show in front of silvery Halloween decorations, and Jamie Lee Curtis likes peanuts. So he's dialed in. He can read a room. Yeah. We have several people that they're just falling, they're dropping like flies. They stop the train everyone starts searching and they start counting heads outside. This is when we get the first of many passenger revolts, where they're like, I'm not going back on that train. In the midst of this, Jamie Lee Curtis hunts down Doc and says, I've figured this out. The person who's killing us is Kenny, the kid we pulled the sex prankageddon on. He was put into a mental hospital. He had supposedly killed somebody by accident or no. She's very vague on details. And therefore, this crack in his sanity must mean that he has escaped this mental hospital and is killing them off. That's the only thing that they have in common.
knew about this masquerade party and when it was going to be and what time he needed to show up for it.
Knows a lot of details about it. I mean, this plan, I couldn't even put on this party, Gina. Nevertheless, hear about a party, then come up with a plan to then disguise myself, enter the party, and start knocking off just a group of 6 or 7 people one by one without being noticed. This person is a genius when it comes down to it.
Well, you know, when you achieve the ability to bend space and time and be in two places at once, certainly hearing about a party in advance would not be beyond your capabilities.
I mean, she really comes down to it of like, hey, what do we have in common? We both have blow dryer damaged hair. We both have very similar screams. We both made Kenny Hampson go cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs by making him almost sleep with a dead body. Oh, and that's when Doc goes nuts. He drags her back inside the train and they lock themselves in a room. I don't even understand why she goes along with this plan. It's the
She doesn't seem that into it.
No, but she also doesn't resist that much. She just kind of goes, she's so shell-shocked, she's just going along with it.
And then she leaves and...
And he's like knocking the knobs off the doors too, or something. Like he was getting really serious about it.
Yeah, and then she eventually leaves, and he's like, "Yeah, all right, I'm just gonna stay here."
Well, he's eliminated almost all of the ways out of the room, and then once he has locked all the doors and made it impossible for anyone to get in from the outside, that's when he goes, "Oh, I should check these closets." He does this backwards. You check everything before you lock yourself into a room and are unable to get out before you start checking the closets. And we get a 5-minute long scene of him opening things and discovering that they're empty and then opening another thing and then going, oh, what's on top of the closet? Oh, what's underneath? And for a second, I thought, oh my God, Gina, we're gonna get bunked. The setup was there. He's sitting on a couch, and I'm like, he's gonna get stabbed through that couch. We're gonna have a get bunked. And nope. We don't get a fucking get bunked. God damn it. This is the third fucking movie in a row where no one gets bunked, and I'm beginning to think, is that ever gonna happen again?
I don't know
if I can go on.
No bunking to be had. And we don't even actually get to see his death on screen, which is a huge disappointment considering what a irredeemably awful character this is.
No, there's that. This should have payoff. I will agree that we're told happens to him is satisfying in a, I'm glad that he got decapitated, but it would have been nice to actually see it happen. But this movie doesn't have a lot of that. There's much more in the Halloween vein of things happen and we just discover bodies after the fact sort of situation.
Yeah, that's...
We did get to see him be scared for a super long time, which is pretty satisfying.
Yeah, that's a good comeuppance.
Yeah. But this allows Alana to tell Karin what her belief is, which is the magician must be doing this because Kenny loved magic and therefore the magician must be involved. They pile everyone into one train car with the exception of Alana and lock the magician in the back. This is a, I guess, a great plan if you're absolutely 100% certain that the magician is actually the killer, but they don't know that. And I think this is when we kind of need to spoil it for people if they don't know who, how this killer has accomplished what they've accomplished. Is this the moment we reveal it, Gina?
I think so, but even when we do reveal it, it still doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You just sort of have to it requires a huge suspension of disbelief to figure out how he would do this and how he would move about unseen, unnoticed, constantly changing clothes, again, you know, painting and unpainting fingernails. Do you want me to say it?
Should I pull the
magician's cloth away and reveal the sleight of hand?
Reveal that rabbit.
Kenny has disguised himself as not the magician, but the magician's assistant. Ooh.
Bum, bum, bah. Fuck this movie, god damn it. I liked it up until this point. Like, it's not the best thing in the world, but I'm like, okay, this is all right. There's the weird, you had a bad experience with sex and that drives you to be a killer. And I'm not a big fan of that, but it was the 80s. This was what they determined in their minds was true. This is, why do we have to have a cross-dresser again?
Yeah,
be the killer.
The same year as Dress to Kill. Let's point out the movie that thankfully at least put the first nail in the coffin of the psycho cross killer trope. Not soon yes. enough, but it did. The funny thing is, I don't think that this character, particularly when he's disguised as the magician's assistant, is ever shot anywhere except from a distance. So, I mean,
No. He has a scene where he talks.
Yeah, that's when it became painfully obvious what was happening here.
Oh, right. You're right. Okay, yeah.
Kenny has a conversation with the magician where, when everyone else is outside, they're finally let back onto the train. Kenny wanders back in and we start to go, why is his assistant's voice so processed? It sounds like a Britney Spears song. They've fed it through several computers and it is not fooling anybody. And that was when it very quickly dawned on me. I will give it this. If the idea here is that this is supposed to be an illusion, Kenny has fooled everyone with this illusion. Okay, but it's not devoid of the same gross transphobic politics that Mar and Psycho is, you know, its own bag of tricks, but Dress to Kill is another one where the third time is a real strikeout for me. And I wasn't a fan, man. It's a real bummer that this is what the direction that they chose to go in.
Yeah, I mean, if they just made him the magician, that would have been fine. Not David Copperfield necessarily, but it was just, this is just such a bizarre twist I guess they felt they needed to make it stand out because up to that point, it was just a very pat revenge, you know, for a prank gone wrong type of movie.
Yes. Well, if we had a Happy Birthday to Me sitch happening where someone yanked off a Mission Impossible mask, I would be more accepting of it. But this is a straight up, not to put too fine a point on it, cross-dressing display. And that's where it seems very doubtful once the camera gets close, and then it makes it even worse. We don't have a Victor Victoria thing going happening here. Kenny could not be less likely to be a medical student or someone who sleeps with dead bodies or a female magician's assistant. He's just unbelievable in every single role he's cast here. Outside of the twirling, he's very believable as a twirler.
Well, here's the problem that I have with this movie, and for the most part, I enjoyed it. I thought it was, you know, silly and entertaining. But this is, would you agree, Patrick and Kara, that his revenge really does not suit the crime. It's a little over the top. I mean, and he comes up with something so elaborate and just a plan that is just so complicated for, I mean, it's a little bit, I mean, we keep comparing it to Prom Night. I mean, in Prom Night, someone died, which is, you know, was revenge for, you know, the killer's sister being killed as a child. This was a shitty prank. And not only did he spend years, evidently, coming up with this really insanely intricate plan, he eventually just starts killing people that have nothing to do with it, which doesn't really put the audience on the side of the killer seeking revenge. I mean, again, the only person that really has it coming is Doc. I mean, the other characters, you know, their crime was just kind of standing around and laughing, and you know, Alana, you know, immediately showed, you know, remorse for what she did. So I'm not sure why he particularly seems to have it out for her, and it's, you know, it's a little much.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're 100% correct there. I think there's part of him that takes the entire group as part and parcel. They all participated, and so they all have to be punished. I'm not saying that's correct, and I'm not saying it's believable, and it certainly does not come off as equatable to what's going on. But yeah.
And they did kind of try to explain just like why he would be doing this by giving them the like throwaway line that was like he killed somebody when he was a kid and it might have been an accident, but like he's crazy. Yeah. So they did talk a little bit about how he's not mentally stable, but I mean, I don't, yeah, it was kind of gross there at the end for me.
Yeah. So from this moment on, what we basically have is a third act chase. It's a cat and mouser. So, Alana now knows that something is up. She has been isolated in a part of the train that has been closed off for years, so much so that everyone has to apologize for the dust that we never see.
It's clean, but it's dusty. I was yes. like, what?
She's being protected by a porter who ends up getting a semi-get bunked. Because he's sitting in a chair and gets a sword through the chest and it kind of goes through the chair. But again, it's a stretch to call it a get bunked. But this makes her vulnerable. And then we get a very long, long chase of her going from one end of the train car to the other. Being chased by a killer that no one else can see. And no one else can touch. He gets thrown off the train at one point and manages to stick on because he's fucking Spider-Man or something. She does find the body of David Copperfield, and he also has been sworded to death inside of his pincushion box. I can't remember what that magic trick is.
I think
called.
It was called like the human pincushion or something that.
I think you're right. Eventually, Alana makes it there's a very weird thing where the killer is wearing a mask for the majority of this, and Kenny has an intimidation technique, which is to grab something and shake it. And this is not frightening to me. It seems to be very frightening to Jamie Lee Curtis's character, but did it frighten either of you when he grabs a flimsy a bunk bed and shakes it a little?
No, because he's a very small man. He looks like he's about 5'6" and maybe 140. Yeah. I mean, I am not a particularly strong woman, but I could totally fucking take him. I mean, it's just he just needs to have something thrown at him, and I think that would do the trick. He's not a physically imposing character in the slightest. He looks like he's about 15 years old, and you know, he does look like someone who would, I mean, I hate to say this, he looks like someone who would do drag, And indeed, the actor, like I said, I read this very extensive interview with this actor, mostly about this role, and he was a drag performer, and he was brought in to add this, you know, to make this character believable, but as himself, he's not scary, he's not intimidating, and it's just. I feel like the shaking thing is, you know, well, we got to make him look at least a little bit scary, and it was not working.
I think I read that same interview, and didn't he say, like, he wasn't even auditioning? He was, like, there bringing his, like, partner into audition.
Yeah.
And then they offered him the role. That was funny.
Yeah, and it's, he said all kinds of crazy stuff in this interview, like that he...
Yeah, it was kind of unreadable.
Yeah, like he claimed that at some point, like, the character was supposed to have had an affair with the conductor, and I'm like... And I was reading, like, what? It's like, when would this have happened? But yeah, I've got to dig that up and post it on the group when the Facebook page.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
Because he really is very, very proud of this role.
Oh, I don't want to take that away from him, but the movie kind of takes it away from him.
Yeah.
So
it does.
This element of surprise thing has worked out for him so far, but Jamie Lee Curtis is able to turn the tables, and we told you that blow up doll would come into handy later on because she uses it as a double for herself. And that's when she gets the jump on Kenny. That begins the cat and mouse chase. She then ends up in the sort of conductor's quarters. And this is where we get the bed shaking. And they lock themselves in slowly by locking doors to the point where she is trapped inside of this cage. That he can very easily stick a Flintstone style crowbar through at multiple times. It's not the best place to hide. Let's put it that way. And finally, he uses this crowbar to pry open the lock that she's managed to lock herself into. She has stabbed him several times at this point. She's put a sword into his kidney, basically. She's slashed his hands. He's slashed her chest and arms and hands. They're very slippery, the two of them. It's just all blood, all upper torso damage for the most part. He manages to pry open the cage door, and that's when Alana stabs him in the face with one of those things you put orders on, like a...
Yeah. Oh, the little spike, the little order spike, yeah.
Yes. In the face.
I think it was straight in the eyeball, too, wasn't it? Like,
it's in the cheek. It's okay. Face damage, and I don't react well to face damage.
No, it's not good.
No. This is the one vicious part of the movie where it actually feels like... People, they show violence as it happens, and that is more effective than the bunk bed shaking that occurred previously.
Yeah.
They continue to tussle between the cars, and that's when she manages to sort of kick him off with her pirate boot, and he sticks to the side like a human fly. He then crawls down backwards like he's Michael fucking Myers back into this car. But luckily Karn has come to our rescue with a giant coal shovel. And at some point the train car has opened up a side panel and he manages to knock him through the opening, and they just so happened to be traveling over a bridge at the time. Luckily for us.
It was kind of unceremonious at the very end there. It was like a little bit, like I felt a little bad for Kenny at the end.
Well,
there.
Yeah, because, I mean, he's pretty much down for the count at that point. And Karn is coming into this fight fresh. Nothing bad has happened to him in the entirety of the movie, other than, you know, maybe his employer isn't going to be happy with his performance. And so he just comes in and pounds the fuck out of Kennedy twice, and he flies out the side of the train and into the icy depths several stories below. And then we get a good 45 seconds of watching his body go downstream.
I was going to say, yeah, we get a nice, he gets a nice little float away sequence.
At one point, Kenny asks Alana to kiss him, and that is very awkward.
And he has another freak out. I love it so much.
Yeah. That's right. That's when he has twirl-a-thon number two.
We get bookend freak outs. No, unfortunately, no filmy curtains to get himself tangled up in.
Yeah, it's through this freak out that's when Karn is alerted to the point where he can sneak in and whack him a few times with that coal shovel. So that's Terror Train, people. Any final thoughts?
You know, I hadn't thought of this movie in years, and having watched it, I can see why. I can see why it kind of disappeared into the recesses of my mind. You know, in one of those, you know, everybody has, you know, a bunch of movies that they recall having seen at some point, but could not tell you anything about it. Like, I did not remember going in the twist in it. I mean, all I could basically remember, well, it takes place on a train, which, you know, obviously the title tells you that, but it seemed to me that it was sort of one of the lesser slasher movies. I mean, again, it was enjoyable, you know, the glaringly ugly and clumsy twist in it. But, you know, it's very much follows the tropes of, you know, the nice girl, you know, the kind of, you know, irredeemable asshole and you know, the various, you know, faceless, colorless people who get quickly killed off, which again is why our podcast exists. Would I say it's a must watch in the genre? No, not really.
It's so close to being good. And
I thought it was pretty fun.
You should don't let we're very jaded here.
Yeah, I think maybe it's because, like, I don't know, I haven't seen as many horror movies as you guys, so, like, the tropes don't feel as old to me. Like, I'm definitely like, okay, I can see everything that's coming from a mile away. Like, I definitely understand this movie, but also, like, the costumes were really fun, and that they're on a train is really fun, and that they're just having this big party, and kind of the sort of self-contained nature of it was just kind of nice until, you know, the end, when I was like, no, please don't.
Why would you do that?
Why would you ruin it? You're doing so well.
The fact that it's a train that they can't really stop and get off, many places, that they're sort of trapped on this thing that has to keep going so that they can get to safety. I like that element of it. I also like the costumes, but the fact that it refuses to show violence in the moment until that final cat and mouse, I think holds it back a little bit, and that twist is just kind of on the unforgivable end, unfortunately. Yeah. It's something I did not remember about it until I committed to it.
It's kind of like the main thing. Like, I feel like it's like basically the whole thing is that it was Kenny.
Yeah. So it's come so close to being a genuine mystery that I wish they had just done one or two more things to make it really pop. And I think then the lack of gore in the moment would have been forgivable. It's just not as clever as I want it to be, but, you know, it's better than Prom Night by
it is definitely
good. 500%.
I mean, at least with this, there was only one red herring, which was David Copperfield, whereas in Prom Night, everybody was a red herring.
Everyone's a red herring, and yet no one is. That's the beauty of Prom Night. It tries really hard and fails really hard at being a red herring factory.
So yeah, that brings us to, once again, everyone's favorite frat game, Choose Your Own Death Venture, and that's when we decide, of all the deaths presented in Terror Train, if we were forced to die that way, what would we choose and why? So, Kira, as our guest, I turn to you first. What say you?
Oh, boy. So none of them are great because I'm terrified of death and I don't want to think about it. But
we're not thrilled about death either, but right. That's not the point of the game.
Yeah. I would have to go with Mo because he gets to die. I mean, they're all basically stabbed, so his seems relatively quick-ish.
It must have been. He apparently did not utter a sound.
He didn't utter a sound, but then they pull him off and everybody's like, Mo, are you going to live? And he doesn't. So I think he doesn't fully die right away, but he's definitely like out pretty quick. He's watching a sweet magic show before he dies. So that's fun, I guess. And it's just, yeah, it's quick and he's surrounded by people that he likes. He's also like drunk. So that might make it a little easier. So yeah, definitely Mo.
Okay. Gina, what item up for bid have you decided upon?
I was initially going to say that I would take Ed's way out because I am a jokester. I like telling jokes and I can definitely see you know, being murdered before I even make it onto the train because that is absolutely something that would happen to me. But on the other hand, I don't want to be slowly run over by a train, even if I happen to already be dead by that point. So I think that I'm going to have to go with the magician's way out, just stuffed in a box and ran through with swords because that's kind of a cool way to be found when you think about it.
True. That's true. In terms of the cool ways to be found, the magician's probably the best. I am going to go with Doc's decapitation because it happens quickly. It happens off camera and he's wearing a very comfortable monk's cloak and it's very breathable. And I feel that it would be loose and I would be confined.
He's probably not wearing pants under that.
Oh, no. No, Doc doesn't wear pants under that. Come on. He's totally 100% freeballing. That's how I personally always wear my monk cloaks with sans underwear.
When you're just hanging around the house in your monk's vestments. Yes.
I mean, he's got a lot of ladies, so he's got to be ready to, you know, take it off really fast.
Or he just hikes it up.
I don't know.
Yeah, like a 50s prom exactly. date. Yeah.
That's convenient.
That's just time efficient when you think about it.
There you go. Plus, if he gets caught by his girlfriend, it's easier.
He's a busy medical student. He does not have time to remove pants. Especially when you consider this is 1980, so pants are very tight back then.
Oh, extremely tight.
Exactly. So that's giving you a couple extra minutes that you just don't need in your life.
That's right. Exactly. So that pretty much does it for Terror Train. Hey, Kara, where can people hear more from you?
Yeah, I host a podcast called Fun Dip and Cherry Coke. It's every 2 weeks now, at least for a little bit, while I settle into a new job in a new city that I'm living in. You can find us on Twitter, Fun Dip Pod, all the social medias. It's basically the same.
Excellent. Do it today. Hey, Gina, where can people find out more about you on the internets?
I write about 70s and 80s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com.
Do it today, people. Hey, you want to say something to us? There's a couple pretty easy ways to do it. Reach out to us on Instagram, Kill by Kill Podcast. We do fun things on there, what I remember. I used to do a lot more fun things, but Apple's operating system now does not allow me to do screenshots. So that took a lot of arrows out of my quiver. I apologize. So I do what I can, people. On Twitter, at Kill by Kill Pod, or have something longer to say to us, killbykillpod at gmail.com. And if you would be ever so kind, well, why don't you rate and review us on iTunes? It helps us find more people like yourselves. It makes us more popular. We rise up the charts. We take over the world and we bring you with us. And there's another way that we're going to help you out. If you have a favorite kill in the Friday the 13th series or even Terror Train, let us know and we will read it on air for everyone to hear. That's our solemn promise to you, the Kill by Kill listener. Don't worry, folks. The body count continues. Happy Halloween. We will see you in a little bit as we resume Friday the 13th, part 8, Jason Takes Vancouver. It is real interesting go. We missed you terribly, Gina, on our last outing.
Aww. But
we will have you back for the next one. And hopefully forever on afterwards. I never, as much fun as I had with our guests there, and I certainly did, you were missed terribly. You helped make this podcast wonderful, and I could not have a better podcasting partner in the world.
Well, I sat at home listening to Mad World over and over again, thinking about how much I missed recording that episode.
You should have taken that time and been on the podcast with us.
Well, I was in Michigan. I could not. I could not hide in the hotel room bathroom. The acoustics are just all wrong for that.
That's true. And Michigan, that's just practically impossible to record inside.
Yeah, do they even have internet there? I don't know.
They just moved past two cans and a string, but they did have lots of Faygo, so that was. I'm never leaving my house again.
There you go.
So you won't miss out on another episode with me.
Excellent. All right. Well, for Gina and for Kira and myself, bye bye everybody. The body count will continue. Bye
bye.
Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.